And then we'll have to be home for you.
We'll call the Committee on State Government Innovation and Veterans back to order. We're going to move on now to the ninth item on the agenda, Senate File 575, Senator Newman, State Agency Rulemaking Adoption Legislative Approval Requirement. Welcome, Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm ready, Mr. Chairman, anytime you are.
Feel free to begin, Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, for the record, my name is Senator Scott Newman, and I am the chief author of Senate File 575, which I am calling the Legislative Review Act. And just as a matter of introduction, I will tell you that Senate File 575 is a very short and simple bill, but I think it has some long-reaching and important ramifications in that this bill would require all rules to come back to the legislature to be enacted before having the force of law. Now, in order for you to understand what my concerns are with respect to current administrative and rulemaking authority, I'm going to try and briefly explain to you its history. And I would ask that you please keep in mind that you will not find any reference in the Minnesota Constitution regarding administrative law or rulemaking because the framers did not envision a complex executive branch with numerous executive departments and agencies. However, by the beginning of the 20th century, the legislature began dealing with emerging social and economic issues by enacting regulatory statutes. By the middle of the 20th century, the state of Minnesota was heavily influenced by the Federal Administrative Procedure Act, and so it developed its own Administrative Procedure Act, which ultimately was codified in Minnesota law under Chapter 14. The historical concept that I think is important for you to understand is that this area of law, i.e., administrative law, is purely a creature of statute established by the legislature. And so in the administrative law area, the legislature empowers the executive branch through its agencies with the authority to perform certain functions, and those functions include rulemaking, administrative authority, and quasi-judicial authority. This, however, in my view, equates to the legislative, executive, and judicial branches of government, all controlled under a single department or agency. As originally conceived, perhaps it was a good idea from a standpoint of expediency to allow a state agency to create regulations, then allow that same agency to administer that agency by issuing permits and licenses. As required by those regulations, and finally to allow the same agency to enforce perceived violations of those same regulations through the quasi-judicial authority. However, something happened in my estimation in the 1980s and the 1990s that the early advocates of administrative law would not have envisioned. The enactment, administration, and enforcement of these rules were no longer about the health, safety, and welfare of our citizens, but rather had become a gateway in which directly contributed to the ever-increasing growth and cost of our government. To illustrate this point, I have prepared a handout for you for your consideration, which describes the difficulties many of my constituents have described to me in their dealings with various state agencies. These are situations and constituents that I personally know and I am aware of. Now, I would ask you to just take a look at the handout, and I would also ask that you keep in mind that the handout indicates, with one exception, my constituents have asked that I not release their name. I want to direct your attention specifically to item number 16 on the handout. That particular situation is one that I bumped into just this past Friday concerning a constituent who was trying to open up a gas station convenience store in a little town of Stewart. And they've invested lots of time and lots of money, and they are literally fearful they are going to lose their life savings because the state of Minnesota will not give them the necessary authorization to open their business. Just this afternoon, I received an email from that business, which I have also got in your packet, in which they have allowed me to use their name, and they have given you the story in some detail. Candidly, members, I'm not sure if I've got the right state agency listed on number 16 or not. But the point that I'm trying to make with the letter from my constituent that I provided to you and the list that I provided to you is that our state agencies very often are not helping our constituents. Rather, they are putting up impediments which are prohibiting our businesses from moving forward and being successful. And that is the reason why I've included these two handouts in your packet. As to current rulemaking authority under Minnesota Statute 14.05, the legislature has the authority to delegate to the agencies the authority to, quote, adopt, amend, suspend, or repeal its rules. These rules, which grant to state agencies the power to create laws which govern our private and business relationship with the state, directly affect our constituents. These rules are legislation that are proposed, adopted, and carry the force of law by those who are not elected or accountable to the citizens of the state of Minnesota. Senate File 575 is an attempt to put the legislature back in charge of legislation by requiring enactment before rules may be placed in place by state agencies. Senate File 575, at this point, what I'd like to do is just go through with you a review of what I believe to be the procedures and the benefits of this bill. What Senate File 575 does is to add an additional step in the rulemaking process before a rule can go into effect. Other than that, it does not alter, interrupt, or amend the ability of agencies to adopt rules. It simply requires the rulemaking process to follow Minnesota's constitutionally dedicated plan of having the legislature enact and the governor sign before a law can become enforceable against our citizens. There are a number of bills that are currently in the legislature which deal with or attempt to deal with the rulemaking process and possible abuses. The benefits that I believe Senate File 575 has over these other bills would be the following. Number one, the bill does not interfere with existing rulemaking process, but it does ensure that the policy considerations reached by the state agencies are consistent with the legislative intent of the bill which originally granted rulemaking authority to the agency. Number two, Senate File 575 preserves the agency's ability to formulate appropriate technical and professional standards which ensure public safety and effective agency operations. Number three, it preserves the legislative and executive branch constitutional checks and balance system of adopting laws by requiring the legislature to enact and the governor to sign before the rules become law. Number four, this bill closes the loop of responsibility by requiring the legislature to ratify the administrative conclusions reached by state agencies in rulemaking process originally delegated by the legislature. Number five, It provides broad flexibility to the legislature in determining the best way to enact proposed rules. For example, the proposed rules could be reviewed by the standing committee of each house having subject matter jurisdiction. It could be reviewed by a joint committee of both the Senate and the House, similar to the Congressional Review Act. Or it could be directed to the Rules Committee, which would be in a position to delegate the authority to review or to send it to the appropriate committee. Finally, the Legislative Review Act does not require any new entity or process. Rather, it anticipates using the legislative and executive branches of government in accordance with our constitutional mandates. Members, I simply think that we currently have a system wherein altogether too much power is concentrated in the hands of too few. Currently, state agencies enact rules, investigate violations of the rules they have just created, and enforce the violations the agencies determined have occurred. Again, all three branches of government under the control of a single entity. I believe it's time that the Minnesota legislature reclaim its constitutional authority, which little by little it has unfortunately relinquished over the last two decades. I think it's time that we begin to recognize the danger to our constituents and to our democracy if we continue on the course of delegating to the executive branch our constitutional responsibility. This, I believe, is the only way our citizens have to hold us accountable and to control the laws of this state which so directly affect their lives. With that, Mr. Chairman and members, I will stand for questions.
Thank you, Senator Newman. Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Newman, I need this kind of clear in my head. I want to make sure that I'm reading this bill correctly. So you want us to pass a law every time there is an adoption of a rule. So you're saying in this bill, in line 111, in line 113, and it has been approved by a law enacted after publication of the notice of adoption. So this bill will bring to the legislature the duty of enacting a law after a rule has been enacted, published. Is that what this bill is?
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator, what I would envision is that there would be rules similar, to what now goes on with various state agencies, and there would be a number of rules. And before those rules can become law, you are absolutely correct. Those rules come back before the legislature, and we enact them. And it's only at that point do they become and have the force of law.
Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Senator Newman, most of the rules that we have in place are for interpreting laws. So we enact and adopt rules that actually explain and expand on the laws that are put in place. The process goes the other way around. This particular piece of legislation that we are proposing is going the other way around, right? I just need an explanation. I just need to know because, the language is very clear. It says it has been approved by a law enacted after publication of the notice of adoption. That means that the rule has been published, and then we come here and we talk about adopting a law for the rule. And we have attorneys here, so I'm looking at you, Senator Thomas, to see that I'm not. Maybe it's late in the evening and I'm just going crazy, but this doesn't make absolutely any sense to me. But of course, I went to law school in Colombia, so maybe I'm just completely wrong.
Well, Senator Torres-Ray, maybe because I'm certainly no attorney, but as I read this, We have very good commissioners, and as I believe, well, put it this way: the way I took it from Commissioner Meyer, the way I understood his testimony the other day was that we're not quite up to par to decide how to make a rule. That's what they're for, and I agree with that. I don't have the educational background as maybe Mr. Meyer or these other commissioners have. But what I do have is an election certificate. And I do take very seriously giving up authority for those not elected, making rules that become law. So as I see what Senator Newman is saying is, let them use their education. That's what we pay them for, to research, develop, give us, the legislature, the knowledge and all the facts. Once they do that, through everything, let them do their public hearings, which we want them to do, and then let them bring that back to us. And then we look at it as the elected officials who are representing the citizens of the state and say, yes, this is good. We agree. So we are going to put our stamp of approval on it. It becomes law. That's how I interpret this, but others might interpret it another way. But that's truly what it's reining in our authority once again back to where it belongs. And I believe, as I see this, based on what numerous residents have come back to certain legislators and said, we believe that there's been an overstepping of authority here. And so as I interpret that's how I take it for myself. Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I totally appreciate your point of view. I guess I'm not going to argue against that point of view. You're entitled to that point of view. I think my issue is more with the process. So, predominantly rules are put in place, and the executive has the obligation kind of to help us figure out, once we enact, really a brief piece of legislation, many times we're going to need, the rule in order to explain. So that's one process for the rule. The other rule is a rule that is basically probably what you describe, the authority that the executive has to really promulgate, certain duties and obligations of the public, and perhaps there is a need for more scrutiny. And we could have that conversation as to, how do we separate that, and how do we bring a process of review of rules, of issues that perhaps, we need to do that. But this, creates a tremendous responsibility for the legislative branch that is being given to the executive branch for a purpose. And so now we're kind of bringing it back, and the volume of work, I think, that we're going to do this, to review all of these rules, and perhaps, the level of preparation that we need to bring to the legislature, not just because we don't have the knowledge, but because, these rules are so extensive, and so the volume of work that we need to do, we're a part-time legislature. There is a process in here that just will not work for this. That's, I guess, is the process that I'm questioning, and the value of incorporating all of that process into the legislative branch.
Senator Newman.
Excuse me, if I may respond to Senator Torres-Ray. Insofar as rules are concerned, they do not just add procedural requirements or explain laws. There are many, many, many rules that involve substantive rights of our constituents. And I don't represent agencies. I don't represent departments. I represent people. And my constituents' substantive rights, their legal rights, are involved in the rules that are adopted by agencies. I think, Senator Torres-Ray, you just made a very, very cogent argument as to why this bill is necessary. Because you talked in terms of how extensive the rulemaking process is and how many there are. And it would be a tremendous burden on the legislature if we undertook that responsibility. And in my view, that is our responsibility. And I think, and I'm very sincere on this, I think that the rules, the substantive law rules that are being imposed on our constituents by the state agencies are and have a tremendous volume and a significant effect on their personal rights. And there is, in my estimation, when we deal with an agency that enacts the rules, administers the rules, and determines the violations of the rules, that is simply too cozy of a system. And I think we're hurting our constituents. And I think it's our responsibility to review because we give the agencies that authority to adopt rules. I don't see anything wrong whatsoever in taking a look at what they have done with the authority that we have delegated to them before that rule becomes law. And then we enact it, not them.
I have Senator Goodwin and then Carlson.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Newman, what I don't know and what you haven't spoken to yet is if this rule comes to the legislature and then if the legislature changes it, then does it have to go back to the agency for the public review process all over again? And if it does, then it's going to have to be approved again. And, you know, I know that there are certain, and I don't disagree with you, that some of the rules are overburdening, unnecessarily overburdening people. But I am concerned about how long a process this could be, particularly on a really important rule that we needed to implement in order to get things done. And also, so I want to ask you that. I want to ask you, first of all, if the legislature will be able to change that rule, and if they change that rule then or reject that rule for that matter, does the rule then have to go back to the agency for public process again as it goes through the first time? And the other question is, what if the federal government sends mandates down that, and I don't know if this happens, but I assume it must sometimes, that we have to create state rules for, or we could lose some federal funds or whatever. I don't know if we create the rules or if the feds normally create the rules for federal mandates, but I assume in some cases anyway that they allow us to create our own rules as long as they're within the parameters that they set forth. So those are two important questions, I think. I want to see if you can answer those.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Goodwin, I'm going to take a stab at it. First of all, in terms of what happens if a rule, and I'm not envisioning a single rule. I'm envisioning a package of rules coming to us. But it would be my belief and it would be my intent that once these rules, now they've gone through all of the normal rulemaking process. We're not trying to alter that at all. It's the final step coming back to the legislature. It would seem to me that, you know, we gave them the authority in the first place because we're the legislature. We can take it away. I think that we could enact the rules as they appear to us. We could amend them or we could reject them. If we reject them, they go back right through the process again, I would think. It would be, in my estimation, if the rules are reasonable and necessary, and reasonable and necessary is part of the rulemaking language, that we could either enact or amend. To your second point, the federal government already has in place what they call the Congressional Rulemaking Act. And that is, you know, a manner in which the federal government handles this. I don't know for sure, but I can't imagine a situation where the federal government would issue a mandate on us, the state of Minnesota, that says you must use your rulemaking powers, you can't go through the legislature. That would really surprise me greatly. So, again, I think that if there was some kind of a federal mandate that came down on us and it requires some kind of rules, we just send it through the rulemaking process like we would in any other case. But on the other end, when it comes back out, we get to look at it again and see if it's reasonable and necessary.
Mr. Chair.
Senator up. Goodwin.
Senator Newman, I'm still questioning what the process is. If we just change the rule, does it not have to go through the entire rulemaking process again and the public process, even if we make a change in it? My assumption is that, yes, it does have to go through the rulemaking process. That could happen year after year. And I'm just thinking we could have some businesses tied up because we don't have a rule, or some areas tied up because we don't have a rule. What do you think?
Senator Newman.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Goodwin, I think that when we enact a law, a bill, and send it off to an agency for rulemaking process, very simply that we put in there that we have the ability to take a look at it after the rulemaking process is done, and we retain the authority to enact, amend, or reject those proposed rules. Because the state agencies do not have any authority to proceed with rulemaking authority unless we give it to them.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Goodwin.
Could we please have one of the agency people come up and that deals with federal issues, too, because we really would like to find out if we do ever promulgate rules based on federal legislation.
Do we have an agency that would like to address that question that Senator Goodwin has asked? Please state your name.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Ken Peterson. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry. In terms of your question, generally the federal government says, you have to regulate at the level they're regulating or at a more strict level. But they don't go into the details of whether or not it's be done by regulation or by state statute. I don't think the most part the state, the federal government cares. That's not their issue.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Newman, I wouldn't be surprised if I were you if the federal government wasn't always overreaching the authority of the states. So don't be surprised, please. The question is, I really like your bill, Senator, and this is a great idea. I'm just the one little, maybe it's a technicality. Would these rules then end up in our statute books, or how would that look? That was the only thing that I couldn't quite. I'm totally on board with what you're doing, but does this language say that it ends up in the statute books, or that's my only concern.
Senator,
I think we got enough statute books.
Senator Newman.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Carlson, we've got more rules than we have statutes.
Yeah.
It would be the way I would envision this, and it would be my intent that the rules that we enact would not be in statute. They would go into rules, because what we are doing is we're putting our stamp of approval on the rules. We are enacting them, but they are rules.
Senator Carlson.
So I'm just wondering do we have to do anything with the language so that we know that that actually is that it's something in the rules as opposed to statute? I don't.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. I can answer Senator Goodwin. Carlson's question. It still would have to go in the laws of Minnesota for that year if we passed it. If we had to pass it on the floor, that is particularly not. Maybe not if we didn't. For sure not if we had to pass it in committee. But if we passed the rule on the floor, it would have to go into the laws of Minnesota. And then the decision from how it gets from there into statute is it's codified. And then it goes into statute afterwards unless it's a short-term rule.
Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make sure we get this right so that I want to make sure we do what you want to do with this, but we do it so that when it's all done, we haven't made a technical mistake about where it ends up.
I would I'll hold that comment. We have a couple of testifiers. Mr. Peterson, did you want to testify? I believe you're on the list. Oh, okay. What was the other one here? Oh, how about if we have Twyla Braze come up from the Citizens Council for Health Freedom? Is she here? Ms. Braze? She's not here? All right. Mr. Peterson, did you have any more you wanted to say?
Mr. Chairman, members, Ken Peterson, Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify. We oppose the bill. Same time, I want to make it clear that Senator Newman has been very thoughtful and very considered this thing very closely. And there are real problems. I think that sometimes you have state employees, as well as local government employees and county employees, that sort of thing, who overreach, who do what they go beyond what they should be saying, to maybe take actions. And I presume some of those cases where he's laid out in his presentation are just individuals, you know, born with sin and certainly carrying that out. Then at the same time, we also, there are some rules which are onerous, which are overburdensome. At the same time, what they are is just an extension. What the rules are in its strictest form is an extension of what the legislature, of just saying how the legislature passed the policy. A rule is just a guide to the public as to how the agency is going to implement the legislated policy. The legislature passed something, and then it said, agency, fill in the details. And that's what a rule does. It shouldn't be, they shouldn't be over going beyond the statute or creating new law. It should never do that. If it's doing that, it should be stripped. And the legislature does have that power, as you know, has a power right now to repeal any set of rules it wants to. And I'm always surprised that the legislature doesn't do more of that. I realize that's a difficult task to go through them all, too. I understand that. But there are just a couple of specific things I'd like to mention in my testimony. And the first is that the bill would delay some non-controversial rules. For example, we have a rule at the Department of Labor and Industry. As you may or may not know, we regulate the workers' compensation system to make sure that it runs correctly. So every year, according to statute, October 1st, we change the medical fee schedule. It's consistent with the statewide average weekly wage for physicians. And sometimes it's 2-3%. And what you do is take that figure and convert it to the various parts of the fee schedule and then increase it. And it's just basically a ministerial act. You've already set out what you want to have done. You made it very clear what you want done, so the agency does it. And I'm afraid that if you this bill takes more of a cleaver approach as opposed to a scalpel approach, that those kind of ministerial actions are kind of overlooked. It'd be needlessly delayed. In this case, the legislature come back in session January, February, and gets around to passing it. Hopefully, it passes it quick, but it may take longer, just knowing the legislative process. So those sorts of things, I hope we could even, if the bill does progress further, I hope we could work out some way of handling that problem. A second objection is that, and Senator Newman was very good about explaining how it works, that you could have a problem of just a real needless waste of taxpayer money and citizens' time. For example, we do the building code. We do it every 3 years. The last time we did the building code was 2006. In 2009, we're in the middle of the terrible downturn in the economy, and so it was decided by the then administration, which I agree with, it made sense, just to forego doing it because the construction industry was just kind of going out of control at the time. So we didn't do it, so we haven't done one since 2006. But what we do is have about 150 people, experts in the field. Most of them are in the construction industry. Some are building officials. We have one teacher from Dunwoody and another from some technical colleges. They come in, they go through the International Building Code and try to make changes, recommend changes that make it more applicable to Minnesota. And they've been working on it for 3 or 4 months. We're starting to get, they make recommendations and it goes into the rules and our experts look at them. And then ultimately our people and then I have to decide, then we'll publish it. But our goal is to get a consensus of all these people. so we don't have to have a contested rulemaking. And so we look at, it gets pretty specific, such as the treatment of winding drum machines in the elevator provisions, or changes in the dimension for semi-rigid copper tubing in the pipe sizing tables for natural gas. You guys don't want to deal with that stuff. You really don't. Now, presumably what will happen, though, I mean, I'm not saying you're going to, but I am concerned these citizens spend their time working on it, and then, I don't know, someone who makes pipe sizing, who makes semi-rigid copper tubing, doesn't like their decision, so comes in and lobbies the legislature to pull that out and stops the whole provision. We all know how the process works. Sometimes it can happen. So I'm concerned that you have these people working on something, redeveloping something, going through, you know, putting their time into it, and it ends up by just a whim or by good. These people aren't lobbyists. By good lobbyists, they somehow derail what was a good move. So those are several of our concerns. And also, I think we need to. This is emblematic of an ancient disagreement between the executive branches and the legislative branch. Goes on. It's been going on since, I presume, since 1789, the Congress first met, and Washington was a president, and the Senate and the House were beating on him. I expect it's been going on the same thing. But there is that tension which goes on. Governor Pawlenty vetoed a similar bill in 2003. Governor Dayton vetoed another bill similar to this. It was a $10,000 or above bill last year. That it's seen, the executive branch sees it in a way different than Senator Newman and you, Senator Perry, are saying that this is an encroachment on our authority. You're saying it's an encroachment on the legislative authority. At the same time, the executive branch, we should acknowledge this, the executive branch sees it as an encroachment upon their authority. So we have this problem, and it's a real problem. It's not a one that's just sort of arm wrestling, but rather it's a real problem just how people see what their role in governance should be. I don't have a solution to that, and I say this just as sort of detail in the problem we're having. With that, I'll take any questions, and I appreciate the time and the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Just a couple of questions here. You've had a long service in state government, quite a few years. I mean, you were in charge of Dolley under the Pawlenty administration. Purpose
administration.
In all those years, how many rules did you bring to the legislature to have repealed?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, members, they all are sent up here, as I understand it. I don't think that no one's ever, it's ever been repealed, though. Is that your question? How many did I send? Every rule is published and sent up here, as I understand it. But what happens, the legislature gets too busy to deal with these things.
Well, maybe that's the fault of the legislature. What I'm saying is that I don't know that I've seen this year yet, and I could be wrong, correct me if I am, agencies coming forth saying that, you know, here are some bills that these rules just have to go, legislature. Just get rid of these things. But, you know, what bothers me the most is that we have given the authority out. Heavens to Betsy, I just read something the other day that on the federal level, there's 80,000 pages of rules this year coming out. You know, and so I look at what the rules are doing here. We wouldn't be here today if there wasn't overreaching of these rules. I truly believe that. But finally, citizens are saying enough is enough. And I've been at two different companies where common sense tells me that either we have commissioners that aren't shaking the trees and the branches and watching over their employees, because some of these that we're hearing of that Senator Newman and I even went out and visited are just plain common sense, and it leads me to believe that power is the backbone of what's happening out there. And I think what Senator Newman's trying to do here is say, wait a minute, we giveth, and it's been exploited. It hasn't been used properly. And so we're going to rein things in, and we're going to look over his shoulder now, and we're going to make sure that we as as I said to Senator Torres Ray, we with the certificate, we're going to put our stamp of approval on that because we're having too many of these complaints come forward. Mr. Peterson wants to...
My best response to that is, I sympathize with it. I mean, I look at some of these things, they're ridiculous. And even some that apply to their own department, they're ridiculous. I'm going to find out more tomorrow about what's going on. However, I mean, I think a better way of handling this is to look at the specific, where you're seeing the problems, look at those laws, and if you don't like them, what they're doing with them, then go back and just take away the rulemaking authority for those laws. And for those agencies, it seemed to me that would actually help you get at the problem more directly rather than what's going to happen. You're not going to be able to look at any of these in very much detail because you get too many of them. And the ones where you're seeing the problems, you ought to try to address those. That's, I think, would work better than Senator Newman's approach. I think he's been very thoughtful and deliberate in his thinking, but it just seemed to me a better approach to look at the specific ones you're getting problems from.
All right. Senator Newman.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to very, very briefly respond to a couple comments made by Commissioner Peterson. First of all, I want to remind you that the rules that we are talking about are not guidelines. Once they are adopted, they carry the force of law in Minnesota. Insofar as non-controversial rules, you know, I guess what I would envision is if we truly have got non-controversial stuff, we just put it in a bill, put it on a consent calendar, and pass it. Finally, the final thing that I want to mention is that the contest between the legislative and executive branch in terms of we are somehow trying to take away the executive branch authority. What you got to understand is we give it to the executive branch in the beginning anyhow. They don't have any authority unless we give it to them.
We had Senator Thompson and then Torres Ray.
You know, Mr. Chair, thank you, but I'll pass. I was essentially going to make the point that Senator Newman just made, so thank you.
All right, Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I am just going to make a final comment just to, for the record, because I don't think I'm going to change any votes. But, Commissioner, you have extended that invitation before. You have said to us, you know, bring it to us. Bring the rule, bring the issues to us, and we'll take care of it. You're extending that invitation again. We have yet to hear one supporter of this. We've never had anyone testifying for the need of this. So thank you for opening that invitation. Hopefully we will hear from the public. I don't have one constituent who has called me to say that we really need to put this in place. So it will be great for us to have those constituents testifying before us, saying that we do have a problem with rules, and so that we can learn what these rules are, and then we can get to work on it. But we haven't done that yet. So thank you for continuing to invite us to do our work.
Senator Lilly.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Commissioner Peterson, thank you. Commissioner Peterson and I serve on his Workers' Comp Advisory Board, and he also testifies frequently at our Jobs Committee bill, or committee. And Senator Torres Ray, actually at that committee, we have heard from people who have told us that the regulations are burdensome and they interfere with their ability to create jobs. They do interfere. We heard from a restaurateur from Rochester. He was quite entertaining and very shared a lot of stories about how this rulemaking does impact his business and how difficult it is. And I don't think that he was specifically talking about Dolly. I think he was talking about overall dealing with the overarching burden of dealing with government agencies. Mr. Chairman, in answer to your question of coming to the legislature with some proposals of eliminating previous rulemaking, I would like to share that, Commissioner Peterson, I don't recall if you had testified to this or if John had testified to this, but I believe there were about 20 sections of law or pieces of sections of law in the Dolly cleanup bill that did deal with eliminating duplicative rulemaking but it was virtually all in I believe it was in the electrical code, but it was in a very small section, and this was law that was duplicative. So we really weren't eliminating very much, but out of as I understand, the building code is volumes of books. I think you have testified previously that it's, you know, 3-inch books, and there are 15 or 20 of these books that have all this in. And just in the building code alone, we couldn't find anything to eliminate, and we're adding to it. And the business community, the job creators, are finding it hard to create jobs. So I applaud Senator Newman for attempting to address this issue that is hindering job creation in the state of Minnesota. And I do know that there are a lot of different proposals. I have one of those proposals of dealing with this differently. But truly, the challenge is that no matter how we come at this task, we are told that that's not acceptable, that we don't have a method of reducing the government burden that job creators and the citizens of the state of Minnesota have. And somehow we have to get our handle around this. And Commissioner, I know that you are speaking on behalf of the whole executive branch, and I believe that we are expressing our frustration at the process and trying to find a way that will work. And I know that we come at things differently, and yet somehow we have to do this because it is slowing down the job creation in the state of Minnesota, Mr. Chair.
Chairman. Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, I missed the initial part of this. I want to ask a question maybe more of Senator Lilly, although I already asked a question of you today, so maybe I've used up my quota. But Chairman, Senator Newman, again, with apologies because I came a little bit late. I know with some of the legislation that have dealt with the rulemaking process, there's been some significant support in the state, say in particular with the environmental rulemaking process. What additional support has been presented either to this committee or to previous committees in terms of support for the legislation?
Senator Newman?
I'm sorry, Senator Cohen. I'm not sure I understand your question.
Are there any outside groups, Chamber of Commerce, Business Partnership, whatever, that are on record in supporting Senate File 575?
Senator Newman?
Now I understand your question, Senator Cohen.
Sorry.
And the answer is this is a bill which is my idea. I have not solicited any input from businesses or organizations other than the handout that I had included in your packet. And to be very candid, Senator Cohen, the genesis of the idea of this bill is simply listening to my constituents and how distressed they are with what they perceive to be overly burdensome regulations that are adversely affecting their businesses.
And
Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, if I could respond. And certainly I wouldn't criticize, in fact, to the opposite, that a member such as yourself could come up with something. We don't have to have everything just handed to us and say, you know, would you carry this bill? But certainly with some of these efforts, I've been struck by significant support, notably business support, outside of the building being something that we need to do. So I just wondered in terms of this bill. The other question I would have, Mr. Chairman, and again, Senator Lilly, I don't know if it's directed toward yourself or Senator Newman, but we've heard a lot of talk about have there been statutory kinds of considerations, rulemaking, that have been an impediment to job creation. And I'm not unsympathetic to that, but at times I think we get a little bit carried away by the rhetoric. And I'd like to know if we can quantify that. And certainly when we had the discussion last year relative to some of the environmental kinds of rules, and I generally, to be fair, have opposed those efforts, but certainly heard some significant discussion where there seemed to be some impediment. And so that's why, Senator Lilly, I was thinking of directing it more toward yourself, that when we throw out the rhetoric, I want to make sure that we can try to quantify the rhetoric. so that if, in fact, and Senator Newman has suggested that there were some people in his district who had concerns, and so arguably, Senator Newman, you could quantify that to some extent. But I want to make sure we can quantify that on a statewide basis as to what the impediment is, as opposed to just coming at it from either a rhetorical or possibly a bias we might have.
Senator Lilly.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cohen, actually, thank you for the question. I think that's an important question that we should be looking at. As the Jobs Committee toured around the state, many from the Jobs Committee this summer, one of the things that we heard was that the complexity of working with government is just taking people's eye off the ball at this time when they need to be focusing on trying to create jobs and trying to maintain their businesses. One of the women that I spoke with had a cleaning business, and in that cleaning business, she said, I'm quitting. I can't run my business anymore because I can't keep track of when to charge sales tax and when not to. So if she's dusting a table such as this one, she has to pay sales tax. But if it's the same surface but it's mounted to the wall, if it's a shelf, then she does not have to pay sales tax. And those types of issues. So now this person is trying to figure out throughout the day how much time did I do in taxable and how much is not taxable. We talked with restaurant owners who had challenges with where lights are placed, with how burners are installed, how all the different issues that they face. I talked with chamber executives from across the state of Minnesota, and the number one thing that they talked about was regulation, and not just the regulation, but the change in the regulation and how that is holding back their members. So these are things that we are talking about and hearing about, and I'm sure your constituents are sharing similar stories as you listen to them talk about how do we create jobs in Minnesota.
And Mr. Chairman,
Senator Cohen,
my last comment, and it's not my intent to get into a long back and forth, but and maybe it's more a complaint of this place than it is the particular bill, and something we've been guilty of as well, and that is where we legislate by anecdote. And I know it's important to listen to folks and listen to what they have to say to us, but at times I wish there was a little bit more quantification. And that's a criticism directed toward both sides, not the present majority, but the past majority as well.
All right, I have two before we go to, we're moving towards a vote here. We have Torres Ray and then Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm going to do this very quickly because I know we have a full agenda. But I just wanted to clarify, Senator Lilly, because you and I are in the Jobs Committee. The individual that came to testify from Rochester read a long list of issues that were city ordinances that he had to deal with Rochester. And I remember that vividly because he talked time and time again about a patio, about a window, about an electrical outlet. And in the electrical portion, the commissioner said, I'll be happy to talk to you about it because I do have jurisdiction over that one. Let's go and talk about it so we can resolve that. And this issue of local taxes, burners, stoves, all of that is city-related. And to say here that we have to resolve these issues because we have complaints, I get constituents' complaints about issues related to the city every single day, and I have to deal with them. But I'm not going to come here and try to say, you know, we're going to have to enact laws after we enact a rule in order to you know, really deal with my constituents. And interestingly enough, Senator Lilly, we carry a lot of power for that. When I call the city and I say, you know, I have a problem with a restaurant, let me tell you, the next day I get it resolved. People meet, they talk, and they figure out a way because the business are so important to the city. And they resolve these issues constantly. Patios are a big issue in Minneapolis right now. So I help my constituents on a daily basis with issues related to this, but they have nothing to do with how, you know, we enact rules and laws. And I just wanted to clarify that because the only testifier that we brought to the Jobs Committee actually was talking about those specific city ordinances that are problematic for him. And I think the city should deal with that.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Lilly, I think maybe, and maybe you heard, maybe you didn't, but as Commissioner Peterson said, we have the right now to repeal rules. And I know a lot of people are new around here, but we've always had that right in the legislature to repeal rules. So when you hear those stories, put a bill in to repeal that rule, whatever it is that pertains to that. We have that ability now. And as Senator, or as Commissioner Peterson said, it makes so much more sense to go after those rules that people are complaining about out there and for us to come in and repeal those than it does to just send every single rule here before for legislative approval. We weren't in on those groups, and I know that the Department of Labor and Industry, you're on the workers' comp group. You know, legislation doesn't happen to workers' comp unless that group agrees on the rules and the legislation. And the same is true with the building codes. As Commissioner Peterson said, they have businesses, they have contractors, and they all go over those, and they know those inside out. And if we get complaints about them, and as far as Senator Newman's issues here, you know, I would say Senator Newman can go in and repeal those rules if he doesn't like them or if they're negatively affecting his constituents. And if he gets enough votes in the body, he'll be able to do that. So I don't see the need for this. I don't see that I want to spend all of my time in this body on doing nothing but looking at rules because, folks, that is what we're going to be doing. And it's going to take an awful lot of committee time, an awful lot of floor time, and a lot of it is just plain unnecessary because the groups have been all brought together. When that isn't the case, and I know there are times when rules I'm thinking maybe of the Department of Human Services right now, some of those rules are not necessarily brought to a large enough group of people to really talk about them or whatever, some of those rules, not all of them. But then we should fix whatever we need to fix and what our constituents are complaining about because we do want business to operate in this state and not have the overburden of too many laws and too many rules. But we already have the ability. We have the right to fix that.
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you. I move that Senate File 575 be recommended passed and re-referred to Finance.
On that motion, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
Tenth item on the agenda is Senate File 1742, Senator Peterson. Legislators Retirement Plan Provisions Modification and Clarification. Welcome, Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm grateful for the chance to present this bill to you this evening. I need to offer the AA1 amendment first just to get the bill in the form that will allow you to better evaluate it. It's as a result of some input from the state agencies related specifically to Senate File 1742.
Senator Gazelka moves the A1 amendment to the amendment, Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's just some language changes specifically that talks about words like retired and changing words just to offer better, some more clarification. I can move into an explanation of the entire bill if that would be okay.
Does everybody have the A1 amendment? Maybe the best thing to do is we move this so it's part of the bill so we can explain in detail. Senator Gazelka renews his motion for the A1 amendment. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Amendment prevails. Now to the bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Section 1 of Senate File 1742 basically relates to the per diem payments that we receive as legislators. It removes the per diem payment in regard to the calculation of our salary. Specifically, you know that current law provides that retirement allowances and other benefits allow the per diem to be calculated into the total salary calculation. Section 2 simply changes.
Excuse me, Senator Peterson, when you say that is for the purposes of
retirement benefits.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
thank you.
And that that retirement portion gets spelled out in Section 3 as we move forward. But in order to make that change in Section 3, we had to clarify that that definition, so to speak, in Section 1. Section 2, it basically just changes. Many of you may know that past legislators have the ability to go on and off the state health plan based on their needs. So, for example, if somebody gets sick, they can come in and purchase the insurance, and when they get healthy, they can go off the insurance, creating some additional costs for the state health plan. What Section 2 does is just change this benefit for retired legislators to be the same as retired judges at the time that they may be unelected, is another way to say it, or as we saw in the amendment, we've changed the word retired to former. So a former legislator, after they would lose an election, they would have to choose basically whether they want to stay on and pay the cost or go off at that time and then stick with that decision moving forward. Then the third section just prevents the contributions, as we talked about, to the retirement account by a legislature. It just does not allow the per diem to be included. You may know that there's a 6% contribution to that retirement fund. The taxpayers contribute that to the legislators' fund, and it basically just removes the per diem from that 6% calculation as well.
All right. I'd be interested to hear from Mr. Bergstrom if he'd want to come forward, just taking a look at the retirement side of it here as he comes up. Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Peterson, on Section 2, is there any projected savings from that? I'm sure that happens. I'm aware that happens. Did they project any savings in that?
Senator Peterson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Gazelka, I do not specifically have that. It varies from year to year. I think that's been documented quite significantly in the news media over the last several years. I've seen it as high as $700,000, and it's down to zero if nobody jumps on the system at will. So,
Mr. Bergstrom, welcome.
Mr. Chair, thank you. My name is Dave Bergstrom. I'm the director of the State Retirement System. Senator Peterson's amendment took care of my concerns from a pension standpoint. I just wanted to clarify that the change only applied to future salary and not past salary, and the amendment takes care of that.
All right. Thank you very much. Further questions? Senator Cohen.
So as I understand Mr. Bergstrom's testimony, if you have someone who retired 4 years ago, we don't face the potential of litigation then with this amendment.
Mr. Bergstrom.
Mr. Chair, Senator Cohen, essentially what it does is salary in the legislator's plan, particularly earned through this session, won't change. It won't go back and take out the per diem piece. Going forward, it will. So I think it lessens the legal challenge potential.
Senator Thompson.
Mr. Chairman, I move the Senate File 1742 be recommended to pass as amended and re-referred to the Committee on Finance.
All right. Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just finishing dessert, but I couldn't resist to come and make a comment. Just want to say that the previous bill just increased our work, and we're going to be here for more hours. And you, Senator Peterson, just decrease our salary. So thank you for doing that to the caucus.
Well, here, I'm going to get on a soapbox here for just a little bit. I'm going to expound like my good colleague, friend, Senator Cohen, has showed me over the last couple of years that you can do. Well, folks, here's what I think has to happen in the future. And I talked to Senator Peterson about this. But because of the light of the way the news media is in today's world, it makes it increasingly difficult. What I would suggest someday, being I won't be in the Senate next year, that some senators get together and they take the politicalness out of what the compensation is
for legislators. In other words, I truly believe the only reason somebody came up with per diem was because they didn't have the intestinal fortitude to set the wage for the legislature or the legislator. So what happens, it becomes a political hot potato every election year at the end of every session, and it does nothing but paint a bad light. I, for one, did research over the last 7 years, just in the Senate. The average take, if you take the per diem and put it in where it's supposed to be, it is part of the compensation. The average take for a senator, now this is just senators, not staff, any of that, was, I believe, $44,000 a year. Now, one might suggest that if you take and want to really have some interesting conversations, take the low and the high of the educational salaries of the professors, the teachers, average them out. Because, you know, it's hard to sit here for many people and say, you know, we put in these hours. Yes, we asked for it. Yes, we did do the election. But let's be fair here. If we could take this political powder keg, it will make for a better election cycle. It will let the citizens know, in fact, that this is what we're willing to pay our legislators. If the average is $44,000 a year, so be it. And we get rid of the per diem issue, which seems to be so contentious every year. And I'm hoping that down the road that we can come together and something like this could be done. Then everybody knows. Then there's no, ooh, that person took, or you get a big write-up from a former Senator Meemaw, you know, on the front page and all that. And, you know, that stuff needs to go away. We, sooner or later, legislators have got to come together and say, no, let's get rid of this and do it right. Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, I think you're about half right. I don't disagree about taking the politics out of this, but as long as we're in a political body, I just don't think that'll happen. Because it's not just simply the per diem. The first year I was chairman of state departments, I carried a cost of living increase for legislative pay. And so that was a 3% or something. And it passed off the Senate floor unanimously. There's another story to that as to why that happened. But it had the support of the Senate. In the conference committee, the House showed up, House Democrats, and said, absolutely not. And the Speaker came down to the conference committee and said that it has to be removed from the bill. And that was a COLA. It wasn't a doubling of salaries. It's a difficult issue, whether it's per diem or salary. That ostensibly was the argument for the origination of the compensation council. That was going to take politics out of this. That didn't work. When I was first elected, when I was a kid, I think the salary was $8,400 a year. And I think the political arguments are always there. You knew what the salary was when you ran. If you took that back, you know, if that was used every year, the salary would still be what it was for the National Congress in 1789 and for the Minnesota Legislature in 1859. So that argument's always going to be there. I don't think it's simply the per diem issue that gets over-politicized, though. So I appreciate what you said about could we take the politics out of the per diem issue and concentrate on the salary? Okay. What's an appropriate salary? And I don't care who the majority is, we'll still have the political problems.
Right. Thank you, Senator Cohen. Ms. James, you found something that we need to correct, I believe.
Mr. Sunday found something that we need to correct. On the A1, on line 1.6, the word next should be changed to 2013. And on line 1.3, the word current should be changed to 2012. And that's because this is going into a codified section of law, and so in the future no one will know what that means. We use current and next.
Ms. James, what line was the second correction on?
Well, I did them out of order. So there's a change on 1.3, change current to 2012. And on line 1.6, change next to 2013.
Thank you.
All right. You've included that as part of the amendment, Senator Thompson?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Senator Thompson renews his motion that 17, Senate File 1742, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
Thank you. It does prevail. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Mr.
Peterson.
Chair.
Twelfth item on the agenda is Senate File 2316, Senator Magnus, Veterans Preference Removal Hearing Board Appointment Procedure Modification. Senator Magnus, I believe you have an author's amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I do. I have the A1 amendment, Mr. Chairman, and that would put the bill into the shape that we would like to see it.
Senator Lilly moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Amendment prevails to the bill as amendment. Amended.
Thank
Senator
you, Mr.
Magnus.
Chairman, and thank you, members. Veterans Preference Removal Hearing Board basically requires that when certain government subdivisions notify an employee who is a veteran of an intent to discharge the veteran from employment, that the subdivision must state that the veteran has 60 days to identify and provide contact information about the person who will represent that veteran before a three-person hearing. And Mr. Chairman, with me, I have someone from Mr. Pugh to help us with the testimony, help explaining the bill.
Please state your name and you may proceed.
My name is Clint Bucher. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. I serve as the Veterans Preference Officer. I thank you for the opportunity to testify, Mr. Chairman, Senators. Basically, since 1907, there have been support for veterans, not only to obtain employment, but also protection from unfair dismissals. Currently, Minnesota Statute 197.46 authorizes a public employer to dismiss a veteran when it is shown there's incompetence or misconduct. That hearing to determine whether there was misconduct or incompetence in a larger political entity where they have their own civil service mechanism is held before that committee. But in a smaller local governments where there is no established civil service commission, it is Minnesota Statute 197.46 states that the hearing shall be before the three-person panel. The panel is selected thusly. The employer selects one representative, the veteran selects one, and those two persons must agree on the third. The reason that we're asking that this particular amendment be adopted is because in some instances, although few, there have been some veterans who have not selected or named who their representative was, and in the worst case scenarios, it drug it out to more than a few months, up to a year. Meanwhile, this creates a burden for the employer, and it does not bring about a fair and a reasonable disposition of the issue. Presently, as was noted, the employer must, under the current law, notify the veteran that if you wish to have a veteran's preference hearing, you must so respond to the notice that the employer is required to provide and respond within 60 days and indicate whether you want the hearing. And if you do not respond in 60 days, you lose the right to a hearing. What this particular amendment would do was not only require the veteran to respond within 60 days, but where a three-person panel is appropriate, that veteran would be so notified that they, the veteran, must also notify who their representative is within that 60 days, and not to do so, the veteran would lose the right to a hearing and all reinstatement opportunities. That's one of two aspects. Before I go to the second one, Are there any questions you would like me to address?
You may proceed.
Okay. The second aspect of amending Minnesota Statute 197.46 came to our attention as a result of a recent state Supreme Court case that pertained to Minnesota Statute 197.46, where it was found that in the current reading of Minnesota Statute 197.46, only the veteran can appeal the decision. That was never the, practical interpretation for many years, but when it was finally pressed, in the Minnesota State Supreme Court, it was found that as it is currently written, it is specifically states only the veteran can appeal. So the second component that we're asking to be included in this amendment is simply to state that either the veteran or the political subdivision has the right to appeal.
All right. Thank you very much. Any questions that we have on the bill as amended? I believe this was an agency bill, Senator Magnus. Is that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, it is.
Okay. Right. Hearing none, Senator Lilly.
Mr. Chairman, I move that Senate File 2316, as amended, be recommended to pass.
To that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you,
Senator
very much,
Magnus.
Mr. Chairman and committee members.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Is Senator DeCrite here? I know he's... Oh, there he is. Our final item is the 16th item on the agenda, Senate File 1842. Senator DeCrite, E-Verify Program Usage Requirement. Members, as you will remember, we took testimony on this bill 2 weeks ago. While we did take public testimony on this bill at this time, we do have a few testifiers on the list. With the lateness of the hour, please be succinct with your testimony as possible. Also, before the bill was laid on the table, we adopted the A1 Authors Amendment, which is in your packets if you need to review that. And we did move the A1 amendment, so the bill has been amended. All right, Senator DeCrite.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. I know there was some talk of possibly having another amendment put on, and at this point, I don't see a need for that. So at this point, what I'd like to do is I'd like to move this bill forward.
All right. Thank you, Senator DeCrite. We're going to go through the testifiers here that have requested. Is Ann O'Brien, Assistant Commissioner, MMB? Welcome, Ms. O'Brien. Please state your name. And I feel bad that Commissioner Showalter isn't here tonight. We here at this committee, we're getting so used to having him here that... But you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ann O'Brien. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Human Resource Management and Minnesota Management and Budget. And I'm here to discuss a few concerns we have about the E-Verify process. As you know, the E-Verify process supplements our current I-9 process, which is our requirement under the federal law, the Immigration Reform and Control Act of 1986, that requires us to verify both employment, eligibility and identity for all new hires, which we currently do. And our concerns surround a report that was issued by the Government Accounting Office in December of 2010, where it suggests that while there have been improvements in the E-Verify system, that there still are several risks and significant issues with the information and that errors are persisting. We are concerned that with the number, we hire approximately 5,000 new hires every year at the state of Minnesota, and with that number leaving 2.6% non-confirmed, that is an increase in the number of people, or that is a potential problem for the number of people who would be non-confirmed as employees, and that because the report also goes on to say that the temporary non-confirmed notices are more likely to affect foreign-born employees, that would lead to appearances of discrimination. We are concerned that this would increase our vulnerability for discrimination complaints. The report also indicates that there is that the system is still vulnerable to identity theft issues, which, of course, is a concern for us, for our employees. Once an employee, we receive a notice under the E-Verify system that a person has received a temporary non-confirmation, the employees are limited in their ability to determine why that non-confirmation happened, and it is up to them and the employer to determine or to work toward resolution of that. The employee files data practices concerns, and then the employer is required to go in daily to see if those concerns have been addressed. In the meantime, we do have a system where we are continuing to use our I-9 process and employment eligibility process. All the HR offices in the state of Minnesota do conduct those confirmations. So it would be our recommendation that we postpone implementation of the E-Verify system until these issues can be corrected.
Any questions for the testifier? Senator Torres Ray and then Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. O'Brien, in this bill in line 161718, the author is proposing that the executive branch appointing authority, that you oversee training for the executive branch and that you also conduct periodic audits of the executive branch. But we don't have a fiscal note. We don't have information about the cost of this. Could you tell us what would it take to do this? I see Senator Carlson. Thank you. I think we do have a fiscal note associated with this. Could you talk about this a little bit? Because I haven't seen it, so I appreciate
Ms. O'Brien.
Mr. Chair, Senator, thank you. We did conduct prepare a fiscal note, and most of the training that would be required is conducted by the federal government, so the training costs would be negligible to us. We would be required to do periodic audits, and we have determined that in the first year it would be approximately 50% of a position, and in ongoing years it would be approximately 40% of a position, which we would be willing to absorb.
Thank you.
Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. O'Brien, if I understand this correctly, you sound like we have many different HR departments. Each department has an HR division or something. I was kind of harking back to Senator Daley's bill for the back office consolidation. Would some of these functions maybe be better off if we had some consolidation of some of these types of procedures that are really the same, whether you're Department of Natural Resources or Deed or Dolly or whatever, that HR is HR, and would that make any of this any easier? I'm just curious.
Ms. O'Brien.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I agree that we could investigate a centralized process for that. However, currently we do, at Minnesota Management and Budget, we do provide policy and guidelines for all state agencies which do have their own HR offices, but they are required to abide by Minnesota Management and Budget rules and processes. And we currently have pretty extensive immigration control review process under the Act since 1986. The problem with this particular issue is that individuals have to see the documents that are being presented by the new employee within the first 3 days of the employment process, or they cannot continue to be employed. So it's important for us to have people in the field that are trained that can review those documents personally to make sure that we're meeting the federal requirements.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Morocco. Well, thank you very much, sir. Man.
I wasn't here after the last one, but.
All right. We have Emily Butler. Is she here?
No, I'll be testifying on behalf of her as well. I'm Jeff Wald, if I may.
Jeff, come on up then. Jeff Wald, University of St. Thomas Legal Services Clinic.
Mr. Chairman, Senators, thank you for this opportunity to testify before you this evening. My name is Jeffrey Wald, and I am a law student at the University of St. Thomas. I am currently a member of the St. Thomas Immigration Law Clinic, and together with Emily, who is not able to be here this evening, we prepared a written testimony, and we submitted that this afternoon. If you currently don't have it before you, there are copies over to my left, and I also have additional copies. So if you're interested in that testimony, I can get it to you.
Mr. Wald, will you also be testifying for Mr. Is it Wiebe? Or?
Virgil Wiebe, yeah, he won't be testifying.
All right, thank you, sir.
You're welcome. So like I said, if you want that testimony, I can get it to you. So I just want to highlight a few points from that written testimony. First, there are errors in the Social Security Administration database and the Department of Homeland Security databases. And as the prior testifier just mentioned, these errors can lead to a disparate impact on identifiable cultural subgroups. Since E-Verify relies on information in both the Social Security Administration and the DHS databases, any discrepancy between the information given by an employee on the I-9 and information in those databases would lead to a temporary non-confirmation. But information in these databases may be wrong because of misspellings, naturalization, marriage, divorce, or other causes. In 2009, according to USCIS, there were 22,512 TNCs resulting from name mismatches. Certain cultural groups, such as those of Arab and Hispanic descents, are disparately impacted because they often have multiple surnames, and employers report being uncertain which name to enter when E-Verify calls for a first name, last name, and maiden name. Secondly, erroneous TNCs can be difficult to fix, and it can be costly and time-consuming to fix them. Once an employee has been given a TNC, the burden is on them to fix any errors in the database. The government acknowledges that it can be difficult to access and fix Department of Homeland Security records. To determine where the mismatch occurred in the DHS database, an employee often must use a Privacy Act request to find the information. In 2009, the average response time for a DHS Privacy Act request was 104 days. Thirdly, E-Verify is susceptible to employer misuse. Even the Social Security Administration has admitted to using prohibited practices. E-Verify is not supposed to be used as a pre-screening tool prior to hiring someone. The Social Security Administration, one of the key federal agencies implementing E-Verify, admitted to using E-Verify prior to hiring someone 25% of the time. The Social Security Administration has also ran volunteers through E-Verify, which is also a prohibited practice. The state of Minnesota could potentially be subject to discrimination lawsuits from employees if the state were to use E-Verify in a prohibited manner. Additionally, the state could be liable if there are data and privacy breaches. As you will recall, in 2009, the information of 500 Minnesota employees was compromised by Lookout Services, the company that Minnesota contracted with to implement E-Verify. After terminating their agreement with Lookout Services, Minnesota was sued for breach of contract. Finally, a private study has been commissioned by the USCIS to study the impact of name and date of birth mismatches on TNCs. USCIS has commissioned Westat to study the impact of name and date of birth mismatches on TNCs and to enhance its name matching algorithm. This report, entitled Evaluation of the Accuracy of E-Verify Findings, was supposed to be completed in the third quarter of the fiscal year 2011. The report is currently being finalized, but there is not yet a release date. I want to thank you for the opportunity to share these remarks with you tonight.
Any questions? Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just for the record, I want to ask the question one more time to Senator LaCroix. So I have two questions, and this is personal, obviously, because a lot of the people who are affected are Latinos, and I am a Latina. So I need to ask that on their behalf. Why are you supporting this is my first question. My second question is, what problem are you trying to resolve, Senator? And I would like you to be clear on the two issues. I would like to know, why are you doing this, and what problem are we trying to correct?
Senator DeCrive.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Torres-Ray. Why am I doing it? Because I am always looking for ways to try and make our government more efficient. And I believe with this program, I believe it, what we can do in a matter of minutes now is taking us weeks. And if we were to hire an employee and go through the expense of training that employee and having that employee possibly even have access to some sensitive data, we just heard some testimony about sensitive data can be compromised, we could, quite frankly, have somebody working within the state that isn't eligible to be working here within the state. So efficiency is the why I'm pursuing it. I will always, in my business and in my time in the legislature, look for efficiencies, because I think that's all about running a good business and it's about running a good state. Your second question again, or did I answer both?
I think what problem prompts you, because we haven't heard anybody testifying on your behalf. We've had attorneys last time and this time, and we have human resources experts coming to say, this is really not efficient, and I would like to hear them actually state that again. But the second part is there a problem that you have identified and you're trying to resolve with this?
Senator DeCrive.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Torres-Ray. The problem that I want to address is the fact that the federal government is paying for this program. We're paying for this program through our tax dollars. And I believe to not use it when it's something that is being paid for, I don't want to call it free, because this certainly is not free. We're already paying for it. My daughter works as an HR in the HR department of a large corporation, and they use E-Verify all the time. And when I ask her, it sounds like they don't run into any issues with it. So I believe it to be a program that we should also utilize in government. There's so many times that I think government runs a lot differently than private business, and I think not in all cases, but I think in many cases government would be well off to run more like a business. And this is one of those cases that I think businesses that want to avoid problems are using this system, and we are not, and I think it's something we should be.
Senator Torres-Ray.
Finally, Mr. Chairman, I would like to call Ms. O'Brien to the chair. And Mr. Walt, if you could just come back too, because you're the expert witness here. So Ms. O'Brien.
Excuse me. Go ahead now.
Thank you, Mr.
They're
Chair.
Both here.
Are we going to correct a problem by implementing E-Verify? Are we being more efficient? Are we going to become more efficient as a result of using E-Verify?
Ms. O'Brien?
Mr. Chair, my name is Ann O'Brien again, Assistant Commissioner, Minnesota Management and Budget, for the record. Senator, first of all, the E-Verify system would be a secondary system to the system that we currently use. So that in its current state, I believe that it's a duplicative process at this point that sets us up for some possible discrimination complaints or appearances of discrimination. So as far as efficiency is concerned, I don't think in its current state it is a more efficient process than we have now.
Thank you.
What Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What about Mr. Walt, in your professional opinion, will the state become more efficient? Do we need this process?
Mr. Walt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Senator Torres-Ray. I can't speak for the state of Minnesota whether there is or is not a current problem with hiring unauthorized workers. My testimony today just concerns the problems that have been notified about the inherent problems in the E-Verify program. So I just wanted to make sure the senators were aware before they voted on this bill tonight that they were aware of there are some inherent problems in E-Verify.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure who to direct this question to, Mr. Walls, maybe, or maybe Ms. O'Brien. We talked about potential discrimination, and of course, we don't want that to happen. But we're talking about verifying people as citizens eligible to work in the United States, whether it's green card, whatever it is. I always thought we relied on our federal government for those kinds of policies and initiatives. And if the federal government has devised this E-Verify system so that we do treat people fairly, ought we not use that?
Ms. O'Brien?
Mr. Chair, Senator, the E-Verify system in its concept isn't a bad concept. I'm not against using that system. But the other components of the federal government have advised that it's not quite efficient enough and that there still are issues in using it, and that is more my concern. Not that it wouldn't be a tool to be used in the future once they worked out the issues that we're seeing.
Further discussion, Senator Daley.
What are the primary issues that you are seeing?
Ms. O'Brien.
Mr. Chair, Senator, according to the GAO, that they are reporting that there is a disparate impact on the temporary non-confirmation notices that has a disparate impact on individuals who are foreign-born. That's one of the primary concerns. And then also that there are still concerns about identity theft, and that the system is still vulnerable to that.
Further discussion? All right, thank you to the testifiers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Torres.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to require roll call.
Roll call has been requested and granted. Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that Senate File 1842 as amended be recommended to pass.
Senator Carlson moves that Senate File 1842 be recommended to pass and sent as amended, sent to the floor. Roll call has been granted and requested. Secretary will take the roll.
Senator Carlson?
Yes.
Senator Daley?
Yes.
Senator Gazelka?
Yes.
Senator Goodwin?
No.
Senator Lilly?
Yes.
Senator Thompson?
Yes.
Senator Troy's ready?
No.
Senator Perry?
Yes. On a vote of 6 to 2, on a vote of 6 to 2, the motion does pass. Thank you very much, Senator DeCrife.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Being there is no further business before this committee, we stand adjourned.